Well, I'm Harold G., and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to commend George and his group for having this. I mean, really. Dave and I were talking a few minutes ago, and Tom, about the it's really, really heartening to know that there are people really interested in Alcoholics Anonymous aside from going to those meetings every night. That there really is a body of history that is really so dynamic and changing. It reminds me a lot of our Constitution. It's a living, breathing, growing program. Our book is that way. Our book is a living, growing document. Somebody once said, Alcoholics Anonymous, I did say my name is Harold G. and I'm an alcoholic. That's, I ain't cleared up much. Our book is a living, growing document. Somebody once said that Alcoholics Anonymous is not to be preserved. It's to be lived. And that's the truth of our society. And Bill always referred to as our society, a society of men and women who share their strength and their hope and their experience. And that's the essence of Alcoholics Anonymous. The power's in our experience. The power is in our collective and our individual experience, and that experience is in these rooms. You know, I must have read Alcoholics Anonymous, this book, 100 times. And it wasn't until a long time after I had begun to read it, I realized what I was reading. Fact. Bill Wilson, all he did was write down what somebody else told him. He strung out a series of ideas together in a book based on what other people told him. And in the book, every time they talk about what they must do, it wasn't what we must do, it's what they must do, the people who wrote it. In the beginning, it says, we are 100 men and women who have overcome a seemingly hopeless condition of the mind and body, and the purpose of this book is to tell other people precisely how we did it. And that's what they set about doing. Bill Wilson doesn't makes it very clear what his intent is, because he tells us that if you've decided that you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, here are the steps we took. Doesn't mean here are the steps Harold Green must take. Here are the steps we took. Take them if you want them. Don't if you don't. My old sponsor used to say that. You don't have to do nothing we say in here. You don't have to follow any of these suggestions or anything. You can do it when you come back. So Bill had this kind of dynamic in his head. He wanted people to share their experience, because he knew very early on that the power was in our experience. And I think Dave was absolutely right. And I think Dave really, that was a fantastic talk on the traditions. I mean, really, it was good. I think Dave really deserves another round of applause for that. I don't think I've ever heard them explain as well or as clearly. But I think that he's absolutely right. Bill, in all his bombast, in all his drive and aggressiveness, had a very humble nature. As he went through that process, he began to understand. Somebody once said, humility is simply knowing who you are. And Bill began to find out who he was, who he really was. And he began to understand that there was a power here, there was a force here that had nothing to do with him, that he could apply that force in any way he wanted to do to change his life. And he sat down and he began to use that force. The history of Alcoholics Anonymous is so broad and so vast, there's absolutely no way that you could talk about it in 1 hour. It's no way. I could talk about the big book for the rest of the week. So I'm going to talk just a little bit. I'm going to try and do like Bill used to do. Bill would say when he'd get up to talk, and they say, well, I'm on the bill to say such and such, but I think I'll spin a few yarns. And I'll spin a few yarns around some ideas. And I think that's what I'm going to do and see if I can put it together so everybody don't go out of here confused. In the beginning, when Bill Wilson, the first time, had Ebby Thatcher in his house in Brooklyn, in Clinton Street in Brooklyn, and here I'm going to commit a little heresy, and all, don't throw no chairs up here because it's my own opinion. I believe Alcoholics Anonymous started right then. It was the first time that the problem and the solution came together. Not only did Ebby bring Bill the solution, which was finding a power greater than himself, he also brought him a planned program of action that he learned from the Oxford group. So the problem and the solution, for the first time, Bill knew what the problem was. Silkworth had told him that he had an allergy, that he had an obsession coupled with a compulsion coupled with an obsession. So he knew what the problem was, but he had no idea what the solution was. Dr. Jung, way over in Zurich, knew what the solution was. He told Roland Hazard what the solution was: a religious experience, a psychic experience, some psychic phenomena. He knew what the solution was, but he didn't know what the problem was. Now, the Oxford group didn't know what the problem was, didn't know what the solution was, and didn't know they had a planned program of action. And when Ebby finally found his way to the Oxford groups, he got the solution, he understood what the problem was, and he got a planned program of action. There are simple absolutes, the four absolutes: honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. And he brought those to Bill. So the problem and the solution came together. And of course, now when Bill went out to Akron and met Bob for the first time, they realized that I'm not even sure they understood this in the sense that we do today. But Bill knew that for a very long time he stayed sober because he had helped other alcoholics. And when he was in the Mayfair Hotel that night, and he was sort of wandering between one end of the hotel lobby and the other, and the gin mill on one side and a hotel directory on the other, and he had $10 in his pocket, he came to understand that he needed another alcoholic to talk to. And he found Reverend Tunks. And Reverend Tunks put him on to Henrietta Seibeling. And I think that one of the things that happens a great deal, particularly here on the East Coast, is that we focus a great deal on Bill's contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous, which is immense. It was half of it. But the other component, Dr. Bob and his whole Akron contingent, and Dr. Bob was a dynamic person on his own, just a different kind of mindset. He was a New Englander. A lot of people don't know, and that's another strange thing. The person that brought the message to Bill, Ebby Thatcher, was from Vermont. Bill Wilson came from East Dorset in Vermont. Roland Hazard, who visited Carl Jung in Zurich in 1933, came from Vermont. And Dr. Bob Smith came from St. Johnsbury in Vermont. I'm not sure what that says about Vermont, but but they had this commonality. But he was a taciturn New Englander. Very simple man, straightforward, said what he meant what he said. And people had a high regard and respect for Dr. Bob until he started drinking. And then people, even though he was a drunk and people knew that he drank excessively, he still had a kind of reputation, a kind of stature in that community that stayed with him. And when he got sober, that stature continued. When Dave talked about Frank Buckman, who first originally began these Oxford group things. And there's an anecdote that goes with that, because when Frank Buckman left his little mission up in New England and went over to England, and he started what they call these third century Christians, third century evangelicals, he had a following. Buckman was a very charismatic man, and he had a following of people, and he did the same thing in England. He's got a group of people around him and followed him, and somebody had the bright idea one day, why don't we take these very simple ideas, these four simple principles, and go to South Africa? And maybe we can teach these principles in South Africa and help alleviate some of this racial tension down there. And everybody, like alcoholics will do, said that although these weren't alcoholics, they sometimes I wonder. But they all jumped up and said, sure, let's do it. The problem was they had a lot of apartheid laws in South Africa, and they couldn't travel together because they were a mixed race group. So they went to the South African government and they cut a deal. They said, if you'll allow us to travel together, we'll all ride in one railroad car. And the government agreed and let them do it. So they all rode in one railroad car, and in order to identify them, they put a sign on the railroad car, and the sign said, the Oxford Group. That's where the name came from. And they traveled all over South Africa, this Oxford Group, and it didn't change anything. But the name stuck. And when they came back to the United States, little Oxford groups began to spring up all over. New York, Akron, Cleveland. And the curious thing about the Oxford groups was they never intended for drunks to show up in their meetings. As a matter of fact, they would have preferred that they didn't. Drunks can break stuff, make a lot of noise. They just assume, you know, Ebby took Bill to an Oxford group meeting down in old Calvary Mission one time. And Bill, he was so taken away that he was going to get up and testify. That's what you do. You get up and you testify. Bill tried to run down the aisle and fell flat on his face. But somebody picked him up and sat him in the corner and gave him a plate of beans and told him to keep still. But I think that the Oxford groups really never intended to have alcoholics come to, and I'm not sure anybody has ever really figured out the dynamic that drew alcoholics there. I think after a while, when people, the word began to go out, there was a time when there was no hope for alcoholics. There just was no place for them to go. They used to lock them up in nut houses. There was nothing for them to do. And then all of a sudden, a few people began to get help and stop drinking. Ebby Thatcher is probably the best example of that. When Roland Hazard brought Ebby down from Vermont to the Oxford group for the first time, they were going to lock Ebby up forever. Ebby had stolen somebody's car, driven it down the highway, ran into a farmer's house, into the kitchen, stepped out of the car, took his hat off, and asked the farmer's wife for a cup of coffee. They were going to put Ebby away forever. But Roland, Carl Jung told Roland that the only thing that could help an alcoholic, the only thing that he had ever seen that would help an alcoholic of his type, was when some of them had a very special experience, a psychic experience, a religious experience. And Roland found the Oxford group. And Roland got sober. And he wasn't really sure why or how, but he thought it might work for Ebby. And so he got Ebby, and it did. It worked for Ebby. And so these Oxford groups began to have alcoholics showing up at their meetings. And as you might imagine, the clashes were going on in Legion. At the same time that was happening in New York, the identical same thing was happening out in Akron. Now, before Bill went to Akron, Dr. Bob Smith had been going to Oxford group meetings for years and years. And and all the people in his group knew that he was a drunk. It's kind of hard to know you're not a drunk when you wind up under the kitchen table every night. And that's what happened to Dr. Bob. So they all knew he was a drunk, but he would never admit that he ever had a problem. And the strange kind of phenomena, the things that happen in this thing we call the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the way it started is just extraordinary. Because About a week before Bill Wilson came to Akron to do his little deal, Dr. Bob went, had gone to one of his Oxford group meetings, and for the first time, he told his group he had a problem, and he couldn't stop drinking. And the group asked if he wanted them to pray for him. And Dr. Bob said, yes, will you pray for me? And a week later, Bill Wilson shows up in Akron, Ohio, saying, I'm a rum-dum from New York, and I need to meet another alcoholic. And when he said that to Henrietta on the phone, she said, our prayers have been answered. And you know, the thing of it is, and Dave is right, Bill do get a bad rap sometime, but Bill was an alky from his heart. I mean, he really was. Bill thought he was going to go out to Akron and take over a tool and die company. He had some proxies. And he was going to, you know, they called Bill a stockbroker. Bill was a stock speculator. He used to sell fast-talking to slow-thinking people is what he did. You know, it was a dynamic. I mean, God set that up that way. You know, that God did that. Put Bill right there, right in front there. Because they needed what he had. Just like he brought Dr. Bob and put him in front of Bill. Because they need what Dr. Bob had. God did that. That was no accident. And they brought their own special things together. And so Bill lost his proxy fight. The whole thing collapsed. He didn't get anything. And that's how he found himself in the lobby of the Mayfair Hotel that night. Now, the Oxford groups in Akron were very, very strong. There were people like T. Henry Williams and his wife Clarice and Henrietta Seibeling, which were very known and prominent family in Akron, the Firestones. Harvey and all the Firestones were really, the tire people, were all involved with the Oxford group. They were really strong and really well thought of. The problem was that they were usually, the membership was usually at a certain level, a certain class. If you had certain amount of money, or if you had a good job, or you were a professional, you found them in the Oxford group, sort of like high Presbyterians. And when the drunks start showing up, drunks were not high Presbyterians. And they would come into their meetings drunk, and it was really creating a problem, you know. And I don't want to make light of it, because the Oxford group had made a tremendous contribution, not only to Alcoholics Anonymous, but to the society of that day. So that when this kind of conflict arose, a lot of people didn't quite know what to do. And then there was a guy over in Cleveland, a guy named Clarence Snyder. And Clarence, you could write, I think they did write a book about Clarence one time. Because you go out to Akron and you could get into a fight talking about Clarence Snyder today. And he's been dead about 10 years now. But Clarence was going to Oxford group meetings in Akron. And there was a problem, because many of the alcoholics, or at least some of the alcoholics that were going to Oxford group meetings, were Catholic. And there really was a conflict. With Catholic drunks going to a meeting, they were complaining that the Protestants were using the wrong Bible. and they just had a lot of confusion. So Clarence decided that they would start a group in Akron. And this is in AA Comes of Age. I was looking at it the other night. And Clarence said, we're going to start our own group. We're not going to have anything to do with the Oxford group. And we're going to call it Alcoholics Anonymous from the book. And now you talk to some people in Akron, and they'll tell you that Clarence Snyder made up the name Alcoholics Anonymous. And you come to the East Coast and stay there, and you get into a fight. But I'm not sure that it really matters. The Clarence realized that the Oxford groups of the day were no longer really pertinent to the needs of alcoholics. That they needed something more. And so they formed a group that was strictly for alcoholics. And the curious thing about that is that Bob Smith supported that. He went to their meetings and supported it. And even though he got a lot of grief from the Akron people, about splitting up and breaking off from the Oxford groups, that's exactly what they did. And as a result of that, the third group that really began in Cleveland began as a group that spun off from the Oxford group. And many of the members who formed that group were formerly members of the Oxford group, who are now members of this new thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And that began to grow. And they did exactly the same thing as Bill and Bob did in Akron. They went to the city county hospitals, and they began to troll for drunks. And their groups began to grow and grow and grow. And so the group, and from the Cleveland group, they began to spin off and form groups exactly the way they formed on the East Coast. And the way that Alcoholics Anonymous grew, very often you'd find people who were like traveling salesmen and people who would be in one place today but might be on the East Coast tomorrow. And they would take what they learned or the book that they had to wherever they were. And they would start talking to people. It happened in Florida, in Pennsylvania, in Washington, D.C. People were traveling and went to these places and brought the book with them and began to talk to other people, and little groups began to form, little groups of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result of that, like Topsy, it began to grow. For some years, some of you know I've been doing some research on early black members, early black groups in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I found, what I discovered in doing research, and I've talked to people, and I've got oral histories from people all over the United States, is that where there were areas in the United States where black people really weren't welcome, and so they couldn't go. And what would happen is white people would go to black areas and start groups. And in many areas where you find groups that were there for years and years and years, they were originally started by white people helping black people get AA started. New York is a good example. New York's Harlem. One of the oldest groups in New York is the St. Nicholas group. They just celebrated about their 50th anniversary, and it was a direct result of that. In Chicago, Bill Williams started a group in Evansville, and a group from Chicago went out to Evansville and helped them get their group started. And I spoke at their 50th anniversary about 4 years ago. And so the groups began to grow exactly the way they grew, where one or two alcoholics came together to help solve their problems. It came together exactly the same way for black or white, and now we're finding the same thing with Hispanics. Not too long ago, we discovered that there was a real gap in some areas of the world where Alcoholics Anonymous, for a variety of reasons, weren't being reached. And so we began to look at some of that. And when I say we, I'm talking about the General Services, World Services Corporation, began to look around the world. I remember once, and I'm going to get back to Akron in just a minute, I was at a forum, a regional forum down in Bethesda, and it was just about the time around 1992 or 3 when the Berlin Wall came down. And many of the Eastern Bloc countries that were not permitted to have any kind of individual or autonomous groups began to experience Alcoholics Anonymous. And we had a really tremendous time. I was on the Board of Trustees at the time. And I remember the elation and the real excitement we felt when we were getting our book translated into Lithuanian and Romanian and Czechoslovakian and all those Eastern Bloc countries. And we went to that forum and we talked about it. And then after we talked about and told translations that we were doing and how many groups in Eastern Europe we were helping, the guy in the back got up and said, how many languages have our books been translated into the African language of Swahili? Same thing happened there as happened here. It got very quiet. Because it turns out at that point there hadn't been any. But what it demonstrated to me was the absolute commitment of our staff in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the minute that became known and relevant, The staff was there. Many of them I know, they're still up in New York. It turns out that we had been corresponding with a missionary priest in Kenya who had translated the big book into Swahili. So we wrote him, and he sent us his translation. And we verified it, and not to make a long story longer, we now have the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in Swahili from that one question. And I think that that's the way our fellowship grows. When we have the spirit and the commitment that we know we have to carry our message because nobody else is going to do it. We must do it ourselves. And Dave pointed out something else that I think that's really important. That it was Robert Frost who said it. That whenever any great civilization declined and fell, there was always one element present. They forgot where they came from. And if we forget our history, if we forget where we came from, we will be like every other society. And so our history becomes absolutely critical and paramount. From the time that we began to get the groups in Cleveland, as they began to get established and grow, we had groups in Akron, Cleveland, New York, and then they began to spring up in between. One of the men that had started, had gotten sober in AA in Maryland, went up to D.C. And again, this is a classic example. The first black group in D.C. was the Cosmopolitan Group. And it was started by a man named Dr. Jim Scott. And Jim Burwell went up to Washington. And he was up in Washington, and when he got to Washington, he met with Jim Scott and helped Jim Scott get the first black group in Washington started, the Cosmopolitan Group. The exact same thing happened in Philadelphia. A guy came from New York. He got ticked off at the people in New York and went to Philadelphia. And he hooked up with some people in Philadelphia, and the groups in Philadelphia got started. And from Philadelphia, they spread all over Pennsylvania. And so our fellowship began to grow, twos and threes and fours and fives, all over the place. And what happened was Bill began to look around 1941, 42, and saw that these groups are growing so quickly and so fast, and they were becoming, our message was not only not being garbled, but the intent was being misrepresented, because it began, what Dave pointed out, groups began to have membership forms, so who could join up. And every group had their own set of rules. Bill said one time, if you put all the rules down on one set of piece of paper one time, nobody could join AA. So he realized around 1946 that they had to set out some guidelines, just as Dave described, and that's all they are, the guidelines. As a matter of fact, they were called the 12 points of unity when they first were published in the Grapevine. And when he published them, nobody wanted to hear nothing about them. They would see Bill coming and they would run. Because they said, Bill, you can tell us about that big white flash you had, but we don't hear nothing about them tradition. But he persevered. He persevered because he knew that the groups were coming to a point where they needed to have a set of guidelines so that they would be able to function among themselves and with AA and with the world as a whole. So the traditions became a part of Alcoholics Anonymous at our first meeting in General Service Conference in Cleveland. And then they realized not too long after that we must have some kind of structure. I mean, as it was now, we were just autonomous groups scattered all over the United States, groups here and there. And while a lot of them were beginning to realize the value of the traditions, it's another thing about Bill. You know, when the way the traditions really got written was, every time something would happen, groups would call up New York, and they called Bill and said, we got this problem out here. You got to come out here and solve it. And Bill went, and somebody said, nah, Bill, you stay here. Let them solve it. So from then on, they would call up, and Bill would say, when they call up and said, we got a problem, he says, you'll solve it, and then call me up and tell me what you did. And that's how the traditions got written. all the groups with all the problems, our tradition is nothing more but our experience. And what Bill recognized early on, and to his credit, and he says this, he said, Bill says that he was a vessel. That's all he was. You know, he was the pipeline. He was not the well. And all he did was just pass on what somebody else told him. And he realized that there was nothing that could happen in Alcoholics Anonymous as long as there was an informed group conscience. And he talked about the first tradition. And he talked about the first tradition that it just makes sense. It just makes sense. Unity just makes sense. That if we don't all stick together, we'll sure as hell fall apart together. So the first tradition really just makes sense. And what he also recognized, and to his credit, that there were things that people will just naturally argue about. I mean, you get two alcoholics in the room, you're going to get three opinions, no matter what you do. He knew that. So what he did was he took out everything that people would argue about. He took it out. Power, prestige, authority, politics, money, removed it. So that all that's left in our traditions is the power to carry them out. No basis for any discussion, no arguments. There's nothing to argue about. The other thing that's really critical about the traditions is that they allow us to give up a little bit of ourselves. Each and every tradition allows us to take a little bit of ourselves and give that up for the good of the group. So that when a group takes a group conscience, and I agree with you, I've been into some of the business meetings, but we argue and fight and holler at each other, and then we'll take a vote. And that's a group conscience. And I might not look, I lost more group consciences than I like to admit, but when the group conscience is made, that's it, as far as I'm concerned. That's the group conscience. And we abide by that. And Bill recognized that I can give up a little bit of myself for the good of the whole. And so our traditions became accepted. And then down the road, Bill understood that our groups were sprouting up. Jesus, how much time we got? I'll be out here running. What time is it? Okay. How long we got? Three? All right. he recognized that our structure was such that we had autonomous groups, but in a lot of areas it was almost as though they were operating independent of anything. There was no real group structure, no group coordination. There was no communications very often between groups, and so he realized that we must have some kind of service structure. And so he sat down around 1965, 66, he sat down and he wrote a series of articles and he called them the concepts, the 12 concepts. And he wrote the 12 concepts for world services, and in the last concept, he labeled them the warranties. And within the warranties, within the 12th concept, there are six warranties that ensure that Alcoholics Anonymous is forever democratic, that no one has any autonomous power or gets raised to any seat of perilous power, is the way he puts it, and that everybody has an equal playing field. He also makes sure that there is a role for the minority, because very often the majority will make a vote, but the minority will have a very, very strong opinion. And he discovered very, very early on that the majority is not always right. So he made a provision so that the minority voice, even though you might have lost the vote, there's always a place for you to voice your opinion. And so the concepts became our general service structure. Then they put together the World Service Charter. And that's simply a charter that spells out how the General Service Conference will operate. And Dave mentioned the General Service Conference, and that how we are all represented through our groups. If our groups participate in our service structure through your general service representative, through your district committee member, through your area assembly, you will always have representation at the conference level. Because the conference is nothing more than members of Alcoholics Anonymous that have been sent to New York to do the business of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the things that is really clear and is stressed to the members of the conference when they come there, not to bring their opinions, to bring their conscience. Not to bring their opinions, because every single group has got their own pet problems, their own pet teeth, and they would have a long list of things that they will come up committed to fight for. But then you get up at the conference and you find out that somebody across the country has the exact opposite point of view from your group. And then you're standing there wondering, well, maybe he's right. And so if you come with your conscience and not your opinion, you can be prepared to hear with an open mind and then make an informed decision. But the General Service Conference is nothing more than you and me and all the people in Alcoholics Anonymous with their single voice through their elected representative at the delegates to the General Service Conference. So our service structure was put in place. And then we recognized something that Dave pointed out, that the engine for the money of Alcoholics Anonymous was our big book. The big book was the engine. It pulled everything else. All the money that we got really came. All the other publications, and there's dozens of them now, all came as a result of the big book pulling everything along. And what had happened over the years is that the book Alcoholics Anonymous had become so well respected and renowned that everybody bought it. We sold it to the armed forces, we sold it to colleges, we sold it to Hazleton, we sold it to ComCare, we sold it to thousands of treatment centers, and as a result, a great deal of our money was coming from outside sources. And so we had to give some serious thought, and I was on the board at the time, and we began what was called a self-support initiative. And I think variations of that have started all along, where we realized back in 1985 that 50% of the groups in Alcoholics Anonymous didn't contribute. This did not contribute whatsoever. We also found out that many of those groups didn't know that they were supposed to contribute. They just didn't know. No one ever told them. They started their group. Sometimes they sent a little money to intergroup, but they just kept the money there. So what we decided to do with our self-support effort was to contact the groups at their closest level through the district committee members and do a self-support effort. Not to get money. That was not the point. Alcoholics Anonymous didn't really need any money. What we wanted to do was to get them to participate within the fellowship. Just simply participate. Send representatives to the General Service Conference. Send General Service representatives to your assembly. Working within the corrections and the treatment facilities in your area. Just participate in the process. And as a result of that, we began to do it. We also changed. There was a time when we had a two-tier system. We sold books to outside entities at one price, and we sold books to members in Alcoholics Anonymous at another price. And we changed that so that everybody had a one-price system, a one-tier pricing system. And that helped a lot. And as what happened, they screwed it up. I mean, big time. Because the first thing that happened, the first time, and this is so typical Alcoholics Anonymous that I laugh every time I tell it, because the first year, the word went out, somehow got off the wire that AA was broke. And money poured in. I mean, literally, thousands and thousands of dollars, our budget jumped unbelievably. And then we ran around saying, no, 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 we're not broke. And it stopped. It stopped. And so we had to go back and start all over again and get people to understand what we really were trying. You know how to do that with alcoholics. You go, I mean, it's like, and so we finally got sort of an even keel. It's not right yet. They're still tinkering with it. But you know, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the way we learn. That's the way we learn. We do things. There are no emergencies in AA. There never are. That's the way we learn. We learn by doing stupid stuff. And then somebody say, uh-oh, we got it. And it happens at the level, at the general service trustee level, as much as it happens right in my group. And so we have this history. And we have this experience, this whole great body of experience that takes in everything. I think of AA as an incredible tapestry. And if you look at a tapestry, on one side of it, there's a beautiful picture. Beautiful picture. But if you look behind the tapestry, there are 1,000 threads going in 1,000 different directions. And if you pull a thread over here, the picture will change over here. You pull a thread over here, the picture will change over here. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. We come from so many paths and directions. We make up that beautiful picture of Alcoholics Anonymous, but we look behind it, there are 1,000 paths that led to make up that tapestry. And every one of them is right. I believe that there are no mistakes. There are no accidents. God does not make accidents. I discovered a very simple truth in Alcoholics Anonymous, that there is one mind that has a billion faces, and that there is one God, one love that is common to all men. And the only thing that separates us is our experience. Our experience is what brings us here. Our experience is what makes us continue to grow. It continues to make us Alcoholics Anonymous, and that will never change. But it's also true that unless we ensure that, we may wake up one day and be just like the Washingtonians. We just disappear. Somebody said that if Alcoholics Anonymous ever collapses, it won't come from without. It'll happen, we'll do it to ourselves. Because we forgot our traditions. We've forgotten where we came from. We've forgotten who we were. I once heard a guy describe it like a great rocket ship. There's a star out in the universe. It's Alpha Centauri. It's about 600 light years away. Take 300 years to get there in a rocket ship. And if you put everybody in this room into a rocket ship and launched it out toward that star, and you didn't tell everybody in that ship over and over and over again, generation after generation, who they were and where they had come from, by the time they got out to that star, they'd just be a bunch of people floating out in space, not knowing where they had come from or who they were. Our traditions and our history is what makes us who we are. It's absolutely critical to our continuation. It was Aldous Huxley, I think, that said Alcoholics Anonymous was the greatest social movement of the 20th century. And he didn't say that, I don't believe, in an elitist kind of way. I believe God always chose the least of them to show the others the way. God somehow gave the alcoholic a very unique, extraordinary gift. He gave us the ability to talk to another alcoholic and have him hear what we say. He given us that gift. And he gave it to the least of them. He gave it to the alcoholic, who is truly the least of them. I always like to think of Jesus and his disciples. He always picked the least of them to carry his message. And if you look at Jesus' disciples, who were they? Thieves and robbers and prostitutes. Who's an Alcoholics Anonymous? God always chose the least of them. And I believe God chose the least of them to show the others the way. So he gave us that gift. He gave us the gift of carrying our message to other alcoholics. Let me get down from here. It's about 3 o'clock. Human mind can only absorb as much as the bottom will stand. There's a place out in Minot, North Dakota, and I heard this story. I go out to a sweat lodge up there a couple of times. Haven't been up there for a while since I've been in Maryland. When I was early on, I go up there, and there's a tribe of Indians called Chippewa, and they meet out in, they have their lodges. They do their sweat lodge ritual out in a place called Turtle Mountain. It's in Minot, North Dakota, and they're called the Turtle Mountain Chippewas. And while I was out there one of the first times, one of the elders, a good friend of mine, he's become a good friend of mine, Running Bear, told a story. And he said that the story is about the wounded healer. Now, the wounded healer is a spirit, an Indian spirit. And he doesn't do anything, except that when a warrior is wounded, the spirit appears in front of the warrior. And he opens his cloak, and he has a wound exactly like the warrior's wound. And the warrior looks at the spirit's wound, and the warrior gets healed. And the first time I heard that, I knew that was AA. Probably now if you said it. Whenever we share our strength, our hope, and our experience, we show somebody else our wounds. And when we show them our wounds, they get healed. So we are, in fact, wounded healers. God gave us that gift, and we're responsible for it. And it's a pleasure to be here today, to hear you people and see you people here, to show the interest in Alcoholics Anonymous. I could probably go on for the rest of the week, but I won't. It's just incredible being here, and I want to thank you all for listening to me.